Washington Post reported that hundreds of Syrian civilians have been killed. The opposition, according to the New York Times, was still barely organized. But U.S. actions gave the insurgents hope. As one leading activist enthused, "With what Obama said, it's going to become widespread now. I think we're going to see lots of people taking to the streets." The uprising did indeed spread, but regime opponents were suffering tremendous losses at the hands of Syrian troops. Hillary Clinton, CIA Director David Petraeus, and Leon Panetta pressured Obama to do more in the summer of 2012. They supported establishing a no-fly zone in Syria, a position Clinton recklessly maintained throughout the 2016 campaign. Despite opposition from many military leaders and explicit warnings from Dunford that establishing such a zone would require us to go to war against Syria and Russia. Retired Navy officer John Kuhn, who had flown no-fly missions over Bosnia and Iraq, said he hoped Clinton was just politically posturing. Because if she is not politically posturing, it's going to be a disaster. Even candidate Trump understood enough to assert that Clinton's proposed safe zones would lead to World War III. If that wasn't enough, the administration hawks, Clinton, Petraeus, and Panetta, also proposed a program to arm and train the rebels. Realizing that the weapons of the U.S. provided would likely end up in the hands of Islamic extremists, Obama resisted. But the CIA was already operating clandestinely in southern Turkey to help get arms to Syrian opposition fighters. The New York Times, despite a steady effort to downplay and sanitize U.S. involvement, let slip an article and a graphic that showed that arms for the rebels had been flooding into Turkey and Jordan since at least as early as January 2012, within weeks of the start of the fighting. By March 2013, The Times reported that at least 160 military cargo flights had arrived not only from Saudi Arabia and Qatar, but also from Croatia. In June, shipments from Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar included rocket-propelled grenades, automatic rifles and ammunition, and anti-tank weapons. The CIA, The Times noted in June, was steering the weapons toward U.S.-backed rebels and away from Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. But with the rebels reeling on the battlefield, Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu and Jordan's King Abdullah II ramped up pressure on Obama to do more. Obama authorized a covert CIA program in 2013, codenamed Timber Sycamore, to train and equip rebels at bases in Jordan and Turkey. The billion-dollar program proved much more successful than a half-billion-dollar one run by the Pentagon to train and arm 15,000 Syrian rebels that only managed to put a few dozen fighters on the battlefield and was canceled in 2015. The rarely mentioned, still classified, and more successful CIA program trained approximately 10,000 fighters and gave renewed life to the insurgency. The first group to receive advanced weaponry and training was Abu Hashem's Hazem movement, which had 4,000 fighters in Idlib, Aleppo, Hama and Homs provinces, and in Damascus. The group's commanders presented the CIA with what one of the leaders described as a complete program for a new future army and social movement. He said that the CIA responded encouragingly. "Go ahead, we'll support you." They gave us the green light. They also gave them tow missiles, anti-tank weapons, and 3 weeks of training at camps in Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Whereas U.S. involvement was covert and illegal, according to international law, the Syrian government invited Russian involvement. The rebels proved no match for the Russian bombing campaign that began in 2015 and made short work of both the Nusra Front and its U.S.-trained allies. As the Syrian government, aided by Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, continued making gains on the battlefield, talk of regime change largely disappeared, and the U.S. limited its objectives to defeating ISIS and preventing the use of chemical weapons. Turkey, which had initially supported the U.S. in demanding Assad's ouster, also had a change of heart, now seeing the main threat as coming from the Kurds, who, with U.S. backing, had seized a large part of northern Syria, creating a rift between the U.S. and Turkey, two erstwhile NATO allies, and deepening ties between Turkey and Russia. Trump, who explicitly disavowed regime change during the 2016 campaign, pulled the plug on Timber Sycamore in 2017, complaining that CIA-supplied weapons were ending up in al-Qaeda hands. He tweeted that he was ending massive, dangerous, and wasteful payments to Syrian rebels fighting Assad. Many in Congress cheered his decision. Syrian government forces backed by Russian aircraft continued to mop up the remaining rebel strongholds, taking the besieged city of Aleppo in December 2017. Expressing a view rarely heard on mainstream media, Columbia professor and international development expert Jeffrey Sachs placed the blame for the Syria debacle squarely on U.S. shoulders and urged a speedy withdrawal. Appearing on Morning Joe on MSNBC on April 11, 2018, Sachs defiantly asserted, "This is a U.S. mistake that started 7 years ago, when President Obama said Assad must go. The CIA and Saudi Arabia together in covert operations tried to overthrow Assad. It was a disaster. Eventually it brought in ISIS. It also brought in Russia. And so we have made a proxy war in Syria. It's killed 500,000 people, displaced 10 million. So what I would like to plead to President Trump is get out like his instinct told him. That was his instinct. But then all the establishment, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Pentagon, everybody said no, no, that's irresponsible. But his instinct is right. Get out. We've done enough damage. 7 years. And now we really risk a confrontation with Russia that is extraordinarily dangerous. Reckless." Hosts Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski tried to steer the discussion along more conventional lines, but Sachs would not be deterred. "I think we have to understand how this happened," he continued. "This happened because of us. These 600,000 are not just incidental. We started a war to overthrow a regime. It was covert. It was Timber Sycamore. The CIA operation together with Saudi Arabia. Still, it's shrouded in secrecy, which is part of the problem in our country. A major war effort, shrouded in secrecy, never debated by Congress, never explained to the American people. We need to agree with Russia on a strategy for ending the fight. That is where this war continues, because we to this day back rebels that are trying to overthrow a government contrary to international law, contrary to the UN Charter, contrary to common sense, contrary to practical path. We can't do it." 2 days later, the U.S., Britain, and France bombed Syria, disregarding Syrian and Russian denials that the government had used chemical weapons against civilians. They also refused to wait for an official report from Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons Investigators, despite the fact that journalists on the ground spoke with medical personnel and other local inhabitants who insisted that no chemical attack had occurred. Members of Congress who took issue with Trump's actions did so mostly on the grounds that he should have sought congressional authorization. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, a member of both the Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committees, responded sharply. "President Trump's decision to launch airstrikes against the Syrian government without Congress's approval is illegal, and absent a broader strategy, it's reckless. We need to stop giving presidents a blank check to wage war," he added, wondering who else Trump would strike. He asked, "What's going to stop him from bombing Iran or North Korea next?" Among the reasons that critics opposed the great haste to bomb, aside from the fact that it violated both international law and the U.S. Constitution, was that Syrian government forces were nearing victory on the battlefield using conventional weapons, and had no rational need to defy the West's red line regarding chemical weapons and risk international condemnation and a military response. In fact, Trump had just announced that he wanted to pull all U.S. forces out of Syria, though he retracted that idea under pressure from his more hawkish advisors. Assad also knew that Trump had received bipartisan praise the year before, when he sent cruise missiles to attack a Syrian airbase. CNN's Fareed Zakaria had applauded Trump's big moment and stupidly declared, "I think Donald Trump became president of the United States." Trump hoped to receive such accolades again. He was also eager to divert attention from the various scandals swirling around his presidency that week, from James Comey's inflammatory new book, to the Stormy Daniels controversy, to the Russian election meddling probe, to the FBI breaking down the doors of his private lawyer Michael Cohen's apartment, home, and law office. Trump had clear, if nefarious, motives for launching the attack. But there was little reason for Assad to risk provoking such a response when victory was so close at hand. Desperate to salvage something from the wreckage in Syria, Bolton, whom Trump had appointed National Security Advisor to replace H.R. McMaster in March 2018, and Mike Pompeo, his recently appointed Secretary of State, tried to resuscitate an Obama-era scheme to replace the 2,000 U.S. troops with an Arab force. This idea assumed new urgency after Trump announced in March 2018, "We'll be coming out of Syria like very soon. Let the other people take care of it now." The obvious choices to take the lead on this, the Saudis and the Emiratis, were already tied down in an ugly U.S.-backed proxy war against the Iranian-backed Houthis in Yemen, a war that had created a humanitarian disaster in that impoverished nation. The credibility of the Saudis, and especially that of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the architect of the slaughter in Yemen, and a favorite of Trump, Kushner, and other U.S. policymakers who saw him as the linchpin of their strategy to contain Iran, was dealt a further decisive blow by his involvement in the shocking murder and dismemberment of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. Bolton unsuccessfully solicited help from Egyptian intelligence chief Abbas Kamel. CFR Middle East expert Stephen Cook mockingly tweeted, "Apparently the new national security advisor doesn't know that the Egyptian government supports Assad." The wishes of the Saudis and the U.S. neocons notwithstanding, by the summer of 2018, it had become clear that Assad was going nowhere, and the mopping up operation had begun. Government forces, aided by allies, had secured more than 80% of the country, including all the major population centers. On July 12th, government forces raised the national flag over Daraa, the cradle of the uprising. Remaining rebel forces were on the run. The New York Times reported that the end game of the Syrian civil war seemed to be fast approaching. Few doubt, the Times noted, that Assad will remain the president of Syria. That outcome was now a foregone conclusion. On December 19, 2018, Trump confirmed that judgment, tweeting that with ISIS having been vanquished, he was pulling U.S. troops out of Syria. The outcry from the bipartisan foreign policy establishment was deafening. Military leaders were also incensed. When word immediately leaked that Trump had also given orders to pull half the U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, a drawdown of 7,000, the foreign policy, military, and intelligence establishments became even more apoplectic. The New York Times reported that General Joseph Votel, the commander of U.S. Central Command, and Brett McGurk, the American envoy to the coalition fighting the Islamic State, fiercely protested the decision to withdraw. Secretary of Defense Mattis promptly resigned, releasing his letter of resignation to the press. McGurk followed closely behind. Not only had Trump rejected the advice of his experts, he failed to inform NATO allies of his plans, with the exception of Turkey's Erdogan, who had urged him to withdraw the troops from Syria. That Russia and Iran also applauded the decision further rankled Trump's critics. Bolton had just recently assured allies that the U.S. would never withdraw so long as the Iranians were still involved. Lindsey Graham, whose obsequiousness toward Trump had previously bordered on the obscene, led the congressional opposition to the move. "If Obama had done this," Graham argued, "we'd be going nuts right now. How weak, how dangerous." That message apparently got through, as Trump, confronted with a fusillade of criticism from all quarters of the military, industrial, congressional, media think tank complex, caved under the pressure, and announced that the withdrawal would occur gradually over 4 months, not the 1 month he had promised. Many doubted it would occur at all. Still, with only a small pocket of ISIS fighters remaining, It looked like Syria's brutal civil war might finally be winding down. The process of reconciliation and rebuilding, though, would be a long, painful one. On December 27th, the United Arab Emirates reopened its embassy in Damascus. Abdul Hakim Naimi, the UAE's chargé d'affaires, told reporters, "The opening of our embassy is a first step for the return of other Arab embassies." This was welcome news for the Assad government, which had been trying to mend fences with other Arab nations for several months. Syria had been expelled from the Arab League in 2011. Their attempts to aid the insurgents having failed, Arab governments now wanted back in hopes of curbing Iranian influence. The following day, even the YPG, the heavily U.S.-backed Kurdish militia that controlled a large swath of land in northern Syria, called on the government in Damascus for help in warding off a threatened attack by Turkey. But Bolton, Pompeo, and their allies would not be so easily defeated. Once again, they began placing conditions on the withdrawal from Syria. They extended the time frame from 1 month to 3 months. They assured regional allies that they would continue the fight until all remnants of ISIS were gone. They implemented policies to safeguard the Kurds against their Turkish antagonists. Clearly, the preconditions were being established for the neocons and their foreign policy establishment cronies to block Trump's decision to withdraw. Even Netanyahu recognized the handwriting on the wall. Meeting with Putin in Moscow the day the insurgents were expelled from Daraa, he announced that he did not object to Assad regaining control of all of Syria, so long as Iran and its Shiite allies were kept tens of kilometers away from the Israeli border. This represented a dramatic reversal, not only of Israeli thinking, but of Russia's role throughout the volatile region. Time magazine's Vladimir Isachenkov wrote, "Netanyahu underlined warm ties between Russia and Israel, emphasizing what he described as their key stabilizing role for the Mideast." Striking a blow for the kind of diplomacy that seemed to be breaking out on a number of fronts in summer 2018, Netanyahu, who had met regularly with Putin in recent years, commented, "Every visit like this is an opportunity for us to act together and try and stabilize the situation in our region and increase security and increase stability." Among those who refused to cede Syria back to Assad was renowned mercenary recruiter and war profiteer Eric Prince. Prince offered to raise a private army to replace U.S. forces, an offer similar to the one the Pentagon had rejected in Afghanistan. CNN military analyst John Kirby foresaw the potentially disastrous consequences of this entire plan, warning that some Arab allies would use operations in Syria as a pretext to engage in a larger proxy war against Iran and provide weapons to the rebels that might force our hands to become involved in the civil war in ways that are not in our best interest. War with Iran seemed to be just what Trump and his advisors desired. Trump reviled the July 2015 nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, that Iran had negotiated with the U.S., Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. According to the widely acclaimed agreement, Iran had mothballed most of its centrifuges, disabled its plutonium-producing heavy water reactor at Arak, shipped 98% of its enriched uranium out of the country, capped uranium enrichment far below weapons grade, and allowed regular inspections by the IAEA. In return, Iran got relief from crippling sanctions, access to billions of dollars in frozen overseas assets, permission to sell oil, and readmission to the international banking system. Using economic privation to bring the Iranians to their knees had been part of a conscious strategy by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. As Bulent Gokay, professor of international relations at Keele University, explained in 2014, Saudi Arabia had decided to flood the global oil markets in order to destroy the economy of Iran. According to Gokay, editor of the Eurasian Studies Network and author of The Politics of Caspian Oil, America supported the policy as it wanted to undermine the influence of oil-dependent Russia. But Iran's catastrophic loss of money from oil exports estimated at $160 billion between 2012 and the end of 2017, combined with the sting of the sanctions, had helped get it to the bargaining table, seeking economic relief. However, the economic benefits expected to result from foreign investments did not materialize, and in 2017, Trump imposed new non-nuclear-related sanctions. Unemployment remained high, economic growth low, triggering protests in several Iranian cities at the end of the year. The fact that the JCPOA had been Obama's signature foreign policy achievement made it an especially inviting target for Trump and the many Republicans who had tried to sabotage it from the start. While it was being negotiated, Republicans broke precedent and invited Benjamin Netanyahu to address a joint session of Congress, in which he berated Iran and denounced the nuclear deal. The following week, 47 Republican senators wrote an equally unprecedented open letter to the leaders of the Islamic Republic, putting them on notice that Congress, not the president, had the ultimate power over treaties. Seeing how strong congressional opposition was, Obama declared that the agreement was not a treaty and therefore did not require Senate ratification. He instead submitted it to the UN Security Council, which voted unanimously in favor. Disdain for the Iran deal was one of the few areas in which the notoriously inconsistent Trump never wavered. During the campaign, he told cheering American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, supporters, "My number one priority is to dismantle the disastrous deal with Iran," which he described as "catastrophic for America, for Israel, and for the whole of the Middle East." But even the pro-Israel audience chortled incredulously when he claimed, "I've studied this issue in greater detail than almost anybody." In office, Trump didn't let up. He surrounded himself with anti-Iranian hardliners and repeatedly disparaged the deal, complaining that it had failed to stop Iran's ballistic missile program, curtail Iran's engagement in regional disputes in Yemen, Lebanon, Iraq, and Syria, or halt Iran's support for what he labeled terrorism. He also took issue with the agreement's sunset clauses that expired after 10, 15, or in some cases, 25 years. In a major presidential speech, he condemned Iran's murderous past and present and deprecated the nuclear deal as one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. More specifically, he stated that, worst of all, the deal allows Iran to continue developing certain elements of its nuclear program. And importantly, in just a few years, as key restrictions disappear, Iran can sprint towards a rapid nuclear weapons breakout. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, challenged Trump's interpretation of the JCPOA, explaining, "President Trump does not seem to have read the agreement. The third line of it states, Iran commits to never developing nuclear weapons. There is no time restriction on that. The word we use is never. The time restrictions relate to voluntary limits on our nuclear energy program that we have undertaken to give the international community confidence that we are sincere in our intentions. Besides that, Iran was still a signatory to the 1968 Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, NPT, which itself prevented Iran from building a nuclear weapon. In pushing for the nuclear deal with Iran, President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry both positively alluded to Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei's fatwa prohibiting nuclear weapons, which Speaker of Iran's parliament, Ali Larijani, argued was more important than state law, because unlike the law, it cannot be changed. Trump demanded a new agreement. Iran refused to negotiate. In October 2017, Trump announced that he would not recertify the deal, which the president was legally required to do every 90 days. Khamenei responded that Iran would continue to adhere to the agreement, so long as the other side has not torn it up. But if they do, we will cut it in pieces. The 78-year-old Iranian leader added, "I don't want to waste our time to respond to the rants and whoppers of the foul-throated president of the United States." Zarif put it more simply, "Once we withdraw, all the restrictions on our nuclear program end. Despite IAEA assurances to the contrary, Trump and UN Ambassador Nikki Haley repeatedly accused Iran of noncompliance. Haley, following a series of controversial predecessors, John Bolton, Zalmay Khalilzad, Susan Rice, and Samantha Power, complained that the IAEA was not able to carry out inspections anytime, anywhere, and went to Vienna in September 2017 to press the case with IAEA head Yukiya Amano. But Amano defended the inspectors, telling reporters, "The nuclear-related commitments undertaken by Iran are being implemented. The verification regime in Iran is the most robust regime which is currently existing. We have increased the inspection days in Iran. We have increased inspector numbers, and the number of images has increased." Agence France-Presse reported that the IAEA has conducted at least 400 inspections of sites in Iran and 25 so-called complementary access visits, snap inspections requested at short notice, since the deal came into force in January 2016. Joint Chiefs Chairman General Joseph Dunford testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee that Iran was in compliance. Trump's appointment of Mike Pompeo as Secretary of State and John Bolton as National Security Advisor represented the final nails in the JCPOA's coffin. Foreign Policy magazine called Bolton a national security threat. The New York Times described him as a political blowtorch. Der Spiegel wrote, "There is hardly a crisis in the world that John Bolton does not feel can be solved with war." Bolton had called for bombing Iran years earlier and condemned the nuclear deal as an unprecedented act of surrender. In firing Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Trump admitted that he'd gotten tired of Tillerson's attempts to restrain him over Iran. He didn't have to worry about Pompeo. While still a congressman, Pompeo had looked forward to rolling back this disastrous deal with the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism. Then, as the CIA director, he called Iran a thuggish police state and a despotic theocracy. Oddly, with Tillerson gone, the main voice of reason and moderation in the president's inner circle was Secretary of Defense Mattis, who had always been a hawk where Iran was concerned. In fact, it was Mattis's belligerence toward Iran that led Obama to force his early retirement as head of U.S. Central Command in 2013. Experts voiced serious concerns. In March 2018, 100 national security veterans, including 50 retired military officers, numerous ambassadors, former senators and government officials, and nuclear experts, urged Trump not to abandon the agreement. Many warned that abrogating the deal would strengthen the hand of Iranian hardliners, who, along with Ayatollah Khomeini, had insisted from the start that negotiating with the U.S. was a fool's errand. On May 8th, Trump announced that the U.S. was officially withdrawing from the horrible one-sided deal. All the other signatories said they were staying in. The Saudis and Israelis applauded his decision. Netanyahu, who had conducted a frenzied one-man campaign to sabotage the deal, hailed Trump's courageous leadership. Trump announced that the U.S. would be reimposing its old sanctions and adding new ones. Those businesses that didn't comply would suffer harsh consequences, as would countries and companies that continued purchasing Iranian oil past November 2018. U.S. officials did cushion the blow somewhat by issuing temporary waivers to some of Iran's biggest oil buyers. Following Trump's May bombshell, many European companies, including Renault, Peugeot, and Siemens, submitted to U.S. blackmail and withdrew from Iran, worsening the already serious economic decline. European refiners cut imports of Iranian oil. In July 2018, the Iranian rial set record lows against the dollar. Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, fired the head of Iran's central bank. Protests grew stronger and louder. The Europeans were livid. Macron warned that the international regime against nuclear proliferation is at stake. He, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and British Prime Minister Theresa May, all of whom had beseeched Trump to reconsider, insisted that the UN Security Council resolution endorsing the JCPOA was still the binding international legal framework for the resolution of the dispute. Some speculated that the Security Council might find the U.S. in violation. But strangely, not a single talking head on CNN or MSNBC, the networks whose experts so glibly and routinely called for sanctions on Russia to punish its alleged misdeeds, thought to call on world leaders to sanction the U.S. for its outrageous behavior. France's Minister of Economy and Finances asked, "Do we want the United States to be the world's economic gendarme? Do we want to be vassals who obey decisions taken by the United States while clinging to the hem of their trousers? Or do we want to say we have our economic interests, we consider we will continue to trade with Iran?" In an article attributed to the Der Spiegel staff, the respected German newspaper bemoaned the collapse of transatlantic unity, stating, "The American withdrawal from the Iran deal is the most dangerous and cavalier foreign policy decision that a U.S. president has made since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. The risk is very real that the move will worsen tensions in an already unstable Middle East and lead to an American-led war against Iran." Der Spiegel was further incensed when U.S. Ambassador Richard Grenell sent out a tweet demanding that German companies immediately begin winding down their operations in Iran. It sounded more like the words of a colonial power issuing orders than those of a diplomat in an allied country. Many Europeans, Asians, and Latin Americans had tired of the American stranglehold over their economies. While discontent with U.S. financial domination long antedated the Trump presidency, Trump's heavy-handedness and penchant for trade wars only worsened the situation. In an op-ed in Handelsblatt, German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas defended protecting European companies against U.S. sanctions, and floated the idea of establishing a European payment system that would bypass the U.S. dollar and establish an independent SWIFT payment system. The euro has begun challenging the dollar for the vaunted and extremely advantageous position as the world's reserve currency, but the renminbi has also been gaining ground. The chorus of discontent grew even louder during the September 2018 UN meeting. With Trump's November 4th deadline approaching, Russia, China, Germany, France, Britain, and the EU announced that the EU was establishing a special-purpose vehicle through which trade with Iran could be conducted outside U.S. control. The goal, they stated, is to protect the freedom of their economic operators to pursue legitimate business with Iran. As one Western diplomat aptly observed, "What is certain now is that thanks to Donald Trump's policy, Europe is working closer now with China and Russia." Such rumblings were given added impetus by Europeans' fear that Trump would precipitate a war with Iran, or provoke Iran, given its faltering economy and growing social unrest, to take action of its own in the Strait of Hormuz. According to what Asia Times columnist Pepe Escobar identified as a newsletter circulating among select EU financial circles, Germany is in deep fear of the Strait of Hormuz being shut, stranding a major supply of her natural gas and oil, and placing her totally dependent on oil and natural gas from Russia. That is why Germany has to hold up the Iranian nuclear deal against all costs. Hence, the newsletter explained, the mid-August 2018 meeting of Merkel and Putin and the floating of a new currency plan to break the control over Germany and the world of the SWIFT chips dollar system. Trump had, just the previous month, berated Germany for supporting the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline project that will run from Russia to Germany via the Baltic Sea, bypassing Ukraine and carrying 55 billion cubic meters of gas. Trump had thrown the July 2018 NATO summit into disarray when he accused Germany, during a breakfast meeting of NATO leaders, of being totally controlled by Russia. "I think it's very sad," he said, "when Germany makes a massive oil and gas deal with Russia, where you're supposed to be guarding against Russia, and Germany goes out and pays billions and billions of dollars a year to Russia. It should never have been allowed to happen," he added. Tensions over Iran had heightened in July, when Trump, apparently responding to a speech by Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, fired off one of his early morning tweets, all in capital letters, that read, "To Iranian President Rouhani, never, ever threaten the United States again, or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before." In September, John Bolton, doing his best Dirty Harry Tough Guy impersonation, snarled menacingly at Iran. "Let my message today be clear. We are watching, and we will come after you." Bolton added, "If you cross us, our allies or our partners, if you harm our citizens, if you continue to lie, cheat, and deceive, yes, there will indeed be hell to pay." He also threatened terrible consequences for anyone who continued doing business with Iran, warning, "We do not intend to allow our sanctions to be evaded by Europe or anybody else." Colonel Larry Wilkerson had seen this all before. Months earlier, he had realized that Trump was taking a page from the George W. Bush playbook on Iraq, in preparing for war with Iran. Wilkerson regretted having helped make the meretricious case for the 2003 invasion, as Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff. Alarmed by the parallels, he wrote a powerful op-ed in the New York Times, in hopes of waking up the American people before it was too late. Wilkerson cited Nikki Haley's mendacious presentation of undeniable evidence that Iran was not complying with UN resolutions on ballistic missiles and Yemen, comparing it to Powell's astonishingly similar and equally contemptible presentation 15 years earlier. He deplored the politicization of intelligence that was again occurring, and the fact that news organizations have largely failed to refute false narratives coming out of the Trump White House on Iran. Wilkerson concluded, "As I look back at our lockstep march toward war with Iraq, I realize that it didn't seem to matter to us that we used shoddy or cherry-picked intelligence, that it was unrealistic to argue that the war would pay for itself, rather than cost trillions of dollars, that we might be hopelessly naive in thinking that the war would lead to democracy, instead of pushing the region into a downward spiral. The sole purpose of our actions was to sell the American people on the case for war with Iraq. Polls show that we did. Mr. Trump and his team are trying to do it again. If we're not careful, they'll succeed." Wilkerson did see one big difference between Bush's war with Iraq and Trump's looming war with Iran. Fighting Iran would make the invasion of Iraq look like a walk in the park or a weekend in Mar-a-Lago. War with Iran, a country of almost 80 million people, whose vast strategic depth and difficult terrain make it a far greater challenge than Iraq, would be 10 to 15 times worse than the Iraq War in terms of casualties and costs. Trump's willingness to unilaterally abrogate the Iranian deal, despite near-universal opposition to doing so, reaffirmed the North Korean belief that an agreement with the United States wouldn't be worth the paper it was written on, and that the only way to prevent a U.S. invasion was by developing a credible nuclear deterrent. Efforts to do so had been in the works for years, but Trump's belligerent rhetoric added to North Korea's determination to accelerate the pace of its nuclear and missile programs. North Korea's remarkable progress and Trump's predictably bellicose response would bring the world terrifyingly close to nuclear war in 2017. Trump had initially dismissed North Korean leader Kim Jong-un as a 28-year-old whack job and a maniac whom China should disappear in one form or another. He later reversed course and said he'd host Kim for a hamburger, but not a costly state dinner. He voiced sentiments strangely reminiscent of those for which Obama had gotten blistered by both Hillary Clinton and numerous Republicans a few years earlier, when he said, "I'll speak to anybody. There's a 10% or a 20% chance that I can talk him out of those damn nukes, because who the hell wants him to have nukes?" Trump's erratic behavior and hostile, if mixed, messaging reinforced North Korean leaders' fears of a U.S. attack, and strengthen their desire to showcase their growing nuclear capability. Memories of the Korean War had never abated in the North, and were kept deliberately alive by leaders whose legitimacy and demand for extraordinary sacrifice depended largely on having protected the people from further American carnage. Reminders of the horrific wartime suffering at American hands abound. The Victorious Fatherland Liberation War Museum in Pyongyang, for example, decries the U.S. imperial aggressors who perpetrated the most brutal slaughter of people ever known in history. General Curtis LeMay, head of the Strategic Air Command during the war, said that the U.S. targeted everything that moved in North Korea, causing the deaths of 20% of the population. This fact is conveyed to North Koreans from the time they are schoolchildren and reinforced throughout their lives. Historian Bruce Cummings told Newsweek that most Americans are completely unaware that we destroyed more cities in the North than we did in Japan or Germany during World War II. Every North Korean knows about this. It's drilled into their minds. We never hear about it. South Koreans, on the other hand, are taught a fundamentally different version of history, one that exonerates the U.S. for imposing the dictatorial Syngman Rhee and empowering wartime Japanese collaborators, who repressed and brutalized the South Korean population for decades. The U.S. wartime bombing that also pulverized South Korea has been largely forgotten. What is remembered is South Korea's more recent economic prosperity, which Soo Kyung-hwang wrote in Korea's Grievous War, is the most commonly cited factor used to justify the U.S. role in the Korean War and the continued presence of U.S. troops. North Korea remains technically at war with the U.S. and South Korea, having never replaced the 1953 armistice with a full-fledged peace treaty. It has safeguarded against U.S. and South Korean military action by training thousands of artillery pieces on Seoul, a city of 25 million that sits just 35 miles from the border. Within range of the North's conventional weapons are also some 200,000 U.S. citizens, and many of the 28,500 U.S. troops in the country. Japan is also well within its striking range. Yet Trump has berated both Japan and South Korea for freeloading off the United States, and said he'd be open to their building their own nuclear arsenals for self-defense. If they're not going to take care of us properly, we cannot afford to be the military and police for the world, he told CNN. Despite continuously rocky relations over the years, there have been moments when understandings between the U.S. and North Korea seemed within reach. In 1994, with the U.S. and North Korea on the brink of war, after North Korea announced plans to pull out of the NPT, former President Jimmy Carter flew dramatically to Pyongyang to meet with Kim Il-sung, staving off a U.S. attack. That October, the U.S. and North Korea signed an agreed framework that resulted in the cessation of North Korea's plutonium program for 9 years. Contrary to widespread belief in the West, North Korea did largely comply with the agreement. It shuttered its only operating reactor, halted construction of 2 additional large reactors, permitted IAEA inspections, and remained a party to the NPT. Former State Department official Leon Siegel estimated that the 3 reactors combined could have produced enough plutonium for 30 bombs a year. What the North sought in return, above all else, was normalized relations with the U.S., which also promised 2 electricity-producing light water reactors and 500,000 metric tons of heavy fuel oil. The IAEA confirmed North Korean compliance with the deal. But the ink had barely dried when Newt Gingrich engineered the November 1994 Republican takeover of Congress. And Gingrich, according to Donald Gregg, former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, and national security advisor to Vice President George H.W. Bush, began to wave the bloody shirt, immediately saying, "It's a bad agreement. We're giving away too much." The U.S. and its allies delayed delivery of the promised fuel shipments and construction of the light water reactors, and reneged on other commitments. Despite the obstructionists then, and the naysayers today, who still loudly insist that North Korea can never be trusted, the deal had largely succeeded. Siegel thought assertions to the contrary were hatched in the land of make-believe. "What people don't know," he reminded, "is that North Korea made no fissible material whatsoever from 1991 to 2003. James Pierce, A member of the State Department team that negotiated the agreement concurred with Siegel. There was a lot in the 1994 agreement that worked and continued for quite some years. The assertion, now gospel, that the North Koreans broke it right away is simply not true. When George W. Bush took office, Secretary of State Colin Powell supported continued adherence to the agreed framework. Others in the administration wanted out. Evidence, however questionable, that North Korea was seeking components for a uranium centrifuge program gave them what Under-Secretary of State John Bolton called the hammer I had been looking for to shatter the agreed framework. But the final blow really came in January 2002, when George W. Bush declared North Korea part of the Axis of Evil, putting it squarely in the neocon crosshairs for regime change. Further efforts to reach agreement during the Bush and Obama years failed. Although North Korea repeatedly stated its willingness to halt its nuclear program if a deal could be struck guaranteeing its security. When the younger Swiss-educated Kim replaced his father in 2011, many hoped for liberalization of the dictatorial regime. But, having learned from the fate of Saddam Hussein in Iraq and Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, Kim accelerated the pace of North Korea's missile and nuclear programs. Obama, largely eschewing diplomacy, responded with an aggressive cyber warfare strategy to slow the North's progress. North Korea's accelerated efforts yielded fruit. On July 4, 2017, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, tested a Hwasong-14 ICBM that it claimed could reach anywhere in the world, including the mainland United States. On August 5th, the UN unanimously slapped new sanctions on North Korea, banning export of North Korean coal, lead, iron, and seafood, exports that counted for approximately $1 billion of North Korea's $3 billion earnings. North Korea accused the U.S. of trying to strangle it and threatened a sharp response. The U.S. intelligence community reported that North Korea possessed as many as 60 nuclear weapons and had developed a miniaturized nuclear warhead that could fit atop a missile. When the North Koreans threatened to fire missiles at Guam, Trump erupted, warning of fire and the fury like the world has never seen. Military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded, should North Korea act unwisely, he tweeted. Among those demanding military action was soon-to-be National Security Advisor John Bolton. On Sean Hannity's Fox News show, he called for preemptive strikes. Before North Korea has dozens and dozens of nuclear warheads on ballistic missiles that can hit the United States, he declared on Secure Freedom Radio on August 10th that you eliminate the nuclear threat by eliminating North Korea. The crisis ratcheted up the following month when North Korea conducted its sixth and by far most successful nuclear test. The weapon, it claimed, was a hydrogen bomb. Initial estimates of its yield ranged from 3 to 10 times the size of the Hiroshima bomb. But subsequent radar images showed that the blast had sunk an 85-acre area on the top of Mount Montauk. New estimates placed the blast at close to 17 times the size of the bomb the U.S. used to eviscerate Hiroshima. The U.N., with Russian and Chinese backing, quickly imposed the harshest sanctions yet on the regime. In response, North Korea's official news agency released a statement threatening to reduce the U.S. mainland to ashes and darkness and sink Japan. Putin condemned the North Korean nuclear test as provocative, but thought the sanctions would be useless and ineffective. The North Koreans, he said, will eat grass but will not give up the nuclear program if they don't feel safe. Nor, he cautioned, would further threats do the job. It's a road to nowhere, whipping up military hysteria. This will lead to no good. It could cause a global catastrophe and an enormous loss of life. China's role has been crucial throughout. As North Korea's principal ally and trading partner, it accounts for 90% of North Korea's trade and supplies most of its food and energy. Trump has said at times that the Korean crisis is China's to solve. But relations between North Korea and China had frayed badly in recent years. North Korea's test of a Hwasong-15 missile followed closely on the visit to Pyongyang by Xi Jinping's special envoy Song Tao, who carried a personal message for Kim. In a clear insult, Kim refused to meet with Song. Kim had already executed his own uncle, Jang Song-taek, the second most powerful man in the country and North Korea's main liaison to China. Among the charges against Jang was that he did not clap enthusiastically enough when Kim entered the room. Still, neither Russia nor China, both of which border on North Korea, wants to see U.S.-backed regime change in the DPRK or war of any sort on the peninsula. They have pressurized both sides to find a peaceful path forward, advocating a freeze-for-freeze agreement in which the U.S. and South Korea would halt their joint military exercises and North Korea would put an end to its nuclear and missile tests. China made clear that if the U.S. and South Korea tried to overthrow the North Korea regime, China will prevent them from doing so. But if North Korea provoked the U.S. and South Korea into taking military action, China would remain neutral. The U.S. had ignored China's red line in 1950, with disastrous consequences. The first break in the diplomatic impasse came in 2016, when the South Korean people rose up in sustained peaceful protest, known as the Candlelight Revolution, against South Korean President Park Geun-hye's corrupt and bitterly anti-communist regime, and replaced the conservative leader with Moon Jae-in, a pro-democracy human rights lawyer who promised friendship with the North. As many as one in three South Koreans may have participated in the uprising. Moon immediately reached out to Kim. Trump accused the South Korean president of appeasement. He had earlier excoriated Secretary of State Tillerson for wasting his time trying to negotiate with Kim. Ignoring Trump, Moon again extended an olive branch to North Korea's leaders, insisting, "We will not give up our goal of working together with allies to seek a peaceful denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula." Then, following the DPRK's powerful nuclear test, Trump further exacerbated the situation by tearing into North Korea in his first address to the UN General Assembly. "Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime," Trump told the assembled world leaders and ambassadors. "The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea." Ambassador Haley added that Kim was begging for war. Kim fired back, calling Trump a mentally deranged U.S. dotard, whom Kim would tame with fire. The escalating threats and insults were followed by massive military exercises off the South Korean coast by the U.S. and South Korean navies, with special forces troops practicing decapitation operations to remove North Korea's leaders and seize its military facilities. Later that month, with President Trump about to embark on a 10-day trip to Asia, the U.S. deployed to the Pacific three aircraft carriers, the USS Nimitz, USS Theodore Roosevelt, and USS Ronald Reagan, with their accompanying cruisers, destroyers, and submarines. Many feared that war was about to start, even though the estimates of casualties from North Korea's conventional weapons alone were astronomical. The Idaho-sized peninsula was armed to the teeth, containing, according to CCNY scholar Rajan Menon, more soldiers, 2.8 million not counting reserves, and armaments, nearly 6,000 tanks, 31,000 artillery pieces, and 1,134 combat aircraft than any other place on the planet. As analysts pointed out, North Korea had more than 10,000 artillery pieces, the fourth largest army in the world, with over 1 million troops and far more reserves, 200,000 special forces troops, and mobile missiles that could put all U.S. troops in the country at risk. No wonder Secretary of Defense Mattis had warned even before the last round of missile and bomb tests, it would be a catastrophic war if this turns into a combat. In October, the Congressional Research Service estimated that 300,000 people could die in the first days of fighting, even if no nuclear weapons were used. A study by the Nautilus Institute in 2012 had concluded that if North Korea used its artillery plus its chemical and biological weapons, and also damaged nuclear power plants near Busan, spreading radioactive materials, 1 million could die on the first day of the war, including many of the American civilians and troops in South Korea. Trump would later estimate that death toll could reach 30 to 50 million people. Still, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham tried to reassure Americans that if thousands die, they're going to die over there. They're not going to die here. He would later insist, all the damage that would come from war with North Korea would be worth it in terms of long-term stability and national security. And war seemed imminent. Former CIA Director John Brennan put the odds of war at 20 to 25%. Others predicted higher. Council of Foreign Relations President Richard Haass thought there was a 50-50 chance that war would break out. War fever also crackled in Pyongyang, as four New York Times journalists discovered while visiting in early October. Nicholas Kristof found the atmosphere more alarming than anything he'd previously witnessed in his visits to North Korea. North Korea is galvanizing its people to expect a nuclear war with the United States, he reported. High school students march in the streets in military uniform every day to denounce America. Posters and billboards along the public roads show missiles destroying the U.S. Capitol and shredding the American flag. In fact, images of missiles are everywhere. In a kindergarten playground, at a dolphin show, on state television. This military mobilization is accompanied by the ubiquitous assumption that North Korea could not only survive a nuclear conflict, but also win it. Americans mobilized with words and deeds to halt the descent to war, signing petitions, holding protests, and pressuring elected officials. Even some Republicans tried to rein in their impulsive president. Senator Foreign Relations Committee Chair Bob Corker, Republican of Tennessee, feared that Trump's bellicosity had put the U.S. on the path to World War III. Democrats were even more aghast. Representative John Conyers and Senator Ed Markey introduced the No Unconstitutional Strike Against North Korea bill, mandating congressional approval before a strike could be launched. Two Republicans were among the bill's 61 House sponsors. Former U.S. Defense Secretary William Perry expressed concern that North Korea might think a decapitation strike was coming and decide to go out in a blaze of glory. Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy and five co-sponsors introduced a similar bill into the Senate the following week. With the late November North Korean launch of a Hwasong-15 ICBM capable of reaching anywhere in the U.S., the DPRK declared itself a complete nuclear state. It had achieved its goal. So when Kim announced in his New Year's Day 2018 nationally televised address that the whole territory of the U.S. is within the range of our nuclear strike and a nuclear button is always on the desk of my office, it had some teeth to it. Trump responded predictably that his nuclear button was much bigger and more powerful, and my button works. The New York Times reported a U.S. military planning for a strike. Then on January 13th, Hawaiians had a terrible scare when a state employee sent out a statewide emergency alert warning that a ballistic missile was heading for Hawaii. The alert read, "Ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill." Under the circumstances, most assumed it was a nuclear attack by North Korea. Panic set in. Aaliyah Wong described the terrified response. Many assumed they would die, but sought shelter anyway. They took cover in mall bathrooms, bathtubs, drugstores, even a storm drain. Hawaii has very few shelters, and houses with basements are rare. There were reports of people speeding down highways and running red lights to reunite with family members. Others called one another to say, "I love you," one last time. It took 38 minutes before the state issued an official clarification. Just 3 days later, NHK, Japan's public television network, alerted viewers of an incoming North Korean missile, but quickly corrected the error before widespread hysteria could take hold. The Japanese had been particularly edgy, given North Korea's repeated missile tests, direct threats, and the fact that Japan was well within the range of North Korea's nuclear weapons. Pyongyang's Korea-Asian-Pacific Peace Committee had declared a few months earlier that the four islands of the Japanese archipelago should be sunken into the sea by the nuclear bomb of Juche, the North's ruling ideology. Japan is no longer needed to exist near us. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe had been pushing for expanded missile defense and a tougher stance toward North Korea. Civil defense drills became commonplace across the country. Some Japanese leaders even began raising the taboo subject of Japan acquiring its own nuclear weapons. South Koreans were even more rattled. A Gallup poll showed that 60% wanted South Korea to develop its own nuclear weapons. Nearly 70% wanted the U.S. to reintroduce nuclear weapons it had withdrawn in 1991. But remarkably, with war seeming imminent, the ice suddenly began to thaw. Kim reached out to South Korea, expressing a desire to restore peaceful and friendly relations between the two countries. Serious talks began. The U.S. and South Korea agreed to postpone military exercises until after the February Olympics in South Korea. North Korea sent a large contingent of athletes and cheerleaders to the Games. The two nations' athletes even marched together in the opening ceremony and fielded a unified women's ice hockey team. Kim also sent Kim Yong-nam, a top government official, and his own sister, Kim Yo-jong, who invited President Moon to visit Pyongyang, which the South Korean president readily accepted. Neither Vice President Pence's famously cold shoulder toward the North Korean visitors during the Games, nor Trump's announcement of a new round of sanctions, could chill the warming relations. Following the Games, South Korean envoys visited Pyongyang and returned with a 6-point agreement, stipulating that North Korea would denuclearize if the military threat against it was lifted and the regime security guaranteed. National Security Advisor Chung Yui-yong, who headed the 10-person delegation, brought news of the agreement to Washington and extended an invitation from Kim to Donald Trump for a meeting. Trump jumped at the opportunity, catching many Washington officials off guard. The United States, at the time, still hadn't named an ambassador to South Korea, or replaced many of the top-level State Department officials who had left on their own initiative, or been fired by Secretary of State Tillerson, as part of his attempt to cripple the agency he headed. The agreement and planned summit augured the possibility of peacefully resolving this seemingly intractable crisis. But international reaction was mixed, and critics tried to derail it. Evan Medeiros, Asia director on the National Security Council under Obama, spoke for many experts when he called the meeting a mistake. "This move is vanity over strategy," he complained. "It validates and advances Kim's goal of being recognized as a de facto nuclear state. You don't give away a presidential meeting for nothing. What did we get for this? Nothing." Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, on the other hand, who had earlier informed Tillerson of Kim's desire to talk with the United States, applauded the announcement, calling it a step in the right direction. Others pointed to differences over how the U.S. and DPRK defined denuclearization, the challenges of verification, and the demands that North Korea might make of the United States. But surprises kept coming. Kim went to China to meet with Xi. It was Kim's first trip outside North Korea since taking power in 2011, and his first meeting with another head of state. The CIA director Mike Pompeo secretly visited Pyongyang and held a productive, though originally unplanned, meeting with Kim. Trump tweeted sanely, "Denuclearization will be a great thing for world, but also for North Korea." In April, the North stunningly announced that it was halting nuclear tests and ICBM launches and shutting down its nuclear test site to guarantee transparency in suspending nuclear tests. While skeptics scoffed that no tests had been conducted for months and that the latest nuclear test had largely rendered the test site non-functional, Kim's words added positive reassurances of North Korea's seriousness on the eve of his meeting with the South Korean president, where they both committed to complete denuclearization of the peninsula and conclusion of a long-overdue peace treaty. on June 12, 2018, in one of the most remarkable reversals in U.S. history, Trump and Kim, who had so recently exchanged insults and threats, met in Singapore. The summit, the first ever meeting between leaders of the two nations, turned out to be strong on camaraderie and promises, itself an achievement after 7 decades of hostility. But weak on specifics, or a concrete roadmap to implement the commitments to denuclearization and the normalization of relationships. Trump hailed the summit as an unmitigated success and found much to admire about the North Korean leader, despite his appalling human rights record. Trump gushed to Voice of America. "He's got a great personality. He's a funny guy. I like him. He's smart, loves his people. He loves his country." The meeting had almost been called off after comments by Bolton, Pence, and Trump himself suggested the Libya model would apply to North Korea, implying that Kim, like Gaddafi, after giving up his WMD, could look forward to being bombed, deposed, sodomized, and murdered. A notion that didn't go over too well with the Korean dictator. DPRK First Vice Foreign Minister Kim Kai-gwan disparaged Bolton on the North Korean media. "We shed light on the quality of Bolton already in the past, and we do not hide our feeling of repugnance towards him." That may have been a reference to North Korea's description of Bolton